Imagine a world where being a teenager feels like drowning in a sea of nothingness, while everyone around you seems to be swimming effortlessly. This is the reality for Victoria Spring, a cynical 16-year-old who believes she's practically dead inside. When mysterious notes lead her to an enigmatic og called Solitaire, Victoria's carefully constructed shell of indifference begins to crack. Alice Oseman's debut novel, written when she was just 19, captures the raw intensity of adolescent alienation with remarkable authenticity. Since its 2014 publication, Solitaire has developed a devoted following, particularly after Netflix adapted Oseman's Heartstopper series, which features some of the same characters. Praised by The Guardian as the catcher in the rye for the digital age, the novel resonates deeply with readers who recognize themselves in Victoria's struggle to connect in a world that feels increasingly disconnected. Victoria Spring is convinced she's living a meaningless existence. She introduces herself bluntly. I overthink things, get sad about them, blog, sleep, and will eventually die. This stark self-assessment sets the tone for her worldview. She sees herself as fundamentally broken, incapable of experiencing the emotions that seem to come naturally to others. School feels like a prison populated by soulless conformists, and Victoria moves through her days with a detached cynicism that keeps everyone at arm's length. What makes Victoria's character so compelling is the authenticity of her voice. She doesn't romanticize her depression or wear it as a badge of honor. Instead, her narration reveals the exhausting reality of constantly feeling like an outsider. Sometimes I feel like the only conscious person among computer-generated extras with limited actions. This isn't teenage melodrama. It's a genuine inability to connect with the world around her. Victoria's blog becomes her only outlet, a place where she can express the sadness she feels without being labeled attention-seeking. I don't blog for followers, she explains. I blog because it's not socially acceptable to say sad things out loud in the real world. This digital refuge highlights the modern teenage experience, where online personas often become more authentic than real-life interactions. The brilliance of Oseman's characterization lies in how she balances Victoria's cynicism with moments of vulnerability. When Victoria watches her brother Charlie building a cardboard tractor with his boyfriend, or when she reluctantly admits her love of Star Wars, we glimpse the person beneath the carefully constructed armor. These moments reveal that Victoria's apathy isn't innate. It's a defense mechanism against a world that feels overwhelming and incomprehensible. The discovery of Solitaire begins innocently enough with a trail of pink post-it notes leading Victoria to an abandoned computer room. The website itself initially appears underwhelming, just an empty blog with the title Solitaire, Patience Kills. But as the story progresses, Solitaire evolves from a mysterious online presence into something far more disruptive. The pranks start small. Star Wars music blaring over the school tannoy, Madonna's Material Girl playing on repeat. But they quickly escalate to more dangerous territory. A fire in a teacher's office, stink bombs in hallways, and eventually a catastrophic fireworks incident at a music festival that puts lives at risk. Each prank is announced on the Solitaire blog, creating a sense of mounting tension as students eagerly anticipate the next spectacle. What makes Solitaire particularly unsettling is how it seems to speak directly to Victoria. The blog posts feature references that only she would understand, like the quote, "Do I dare disturb the universe?" a line from T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock that resonates with her sense of existential paralysis. When Victoria is locked in a classroom and shown a beautiful video of young musicians playing violin, she feels moved in a way she hasn't experienced in years. The mystery deepens as Victoria realizes Solitaire isn't just causing chaos, it's trying to communicate something specific to her. This personalization transforms what might have been a simple school prank narrative into something more psychologically complex. Is Solitaire trying to wake Victoria from her emotional numbness? Is it reflecting her own repressed desire for destruction, Or is someone using Solitaire to forge a connection with her that they can't achieve in person? The genius of Osamund's plotting is how she intertwines the Solitaire mystery with Victoria's internal journey. Each escalating prank mirrors Victoria's own increasing emotional volatility, creating a narrative where external events and internal psychology become inextricably linked. As Solitaire's pranks grow more dangerous, Victoria's carefully maintained emotional walls begin to crumble. Into Victoria's carefully maintained isolation bursts Michael Holden, a boy with mismatched eyes, enormous glasses, and an inexplicable enthusiasm for life that both irritates and fascinates Victoria. Their first meeting sets the tone for their relationship. Michael dramatically recognizes Victoria, shouts her full name, and immediately tries to involve her in investigating Solitaire. His energy is the perfect foil to Victoria's apathy. What makes Michael such a compelling character is his refusal to accept Victoria's self-imposed isolation. When she asks why he wants to be friends with her when they're not similar in any way, he offers a profound insight. There's a time and place for being normal. For most people, normal is their default setting. But for some, like you and me, normal is something we have to bring out, like putting on a suit for a posh dinner. This recognition that they're both outsiders, albeit in different ways, forms the foundation of their connection. Their relationship develops through a series of unexpected encounters. When Victoria's brother Charlie has a mental health crisis, Michael appears at her house the next day, making chocolate cake with her 7-year-old brother Oliver and watching movies until they both cry at the Royal Tenenbaums. When Victoria impulsively visits Michael's clifftop home, they spend the day ice skating, where she discovers he's actually a champion speed skater, playing music in antique shops, and watching Star Wars. These moments of genuine connection stand in stark contrast to Victoria's usual emotional detachment. What's most striking about their friendship is how Michael sees through Victoria's carefully constructed facade. When she claims to hate reading, he catches her references to classic literature. When she insists she's boring, he vehemently disagrees. He tells her directly, "You like to act as if you care about nothing, and if you carry on like that, then you're going to drown in the abyss you have imagined for yourself." His ability to articulate the self-destructive nature of Victoria's worldview makes him both threatening and essential to her. Their relationship isn't without conflict. Victoria's tendency to push people away leads to arguments where she accuses Michael of treating her like a manically depressed psychopath. But what makes their connection meaningful is Michael's persistence, his refusal to be driven away by Victoria's defense mechanisms. In a world where Victoria believes everyone is fake, Michael's authentic, unfiltered approach to life offers a glimpse of a different way of being. At the heart of Victoria's story is her relationship with her brother Charlie, whose mental health struggles provide crucial context for understanding Victoria's own emotional state. Charlie has recently been through a severe crisis involving an eating disorder and self-harm that led to a suicide attempt. Though he's now in therapy and working on recovery, the impact of his illness reverberates through the family. Victoria's relationship with Charlie is characterized by fierce protectiveness and unspoken guilt. When Charlie relapses, organizing food obsessively in the kitchen and self-harming, Victoria's immediate response is to comfort him while simultaneously blaming his boyfriend Nick for leaving him alone. Later, she reveals to Lucas that she blames herself for not recognizing the signs of Charlie's deteriorating mental health. "I saw him getting thinner and thinner, and I didn't do anything." This sense of responsibility for Charlie's well-being creates a complex dynamic where Victoria feels she must remain vigilant while also maintaining an appearance of normalcy. Her own emotional struggles are pushed aside as secondary to Charlie's more visible crisis. When her father lectures her about needing to try to be happier, she thinks bitterly that she's been trying for 16 years, a poignant indication that her own mental health issues have gone largely unrecognized by her family. The portrayal of Victoria's parents adds another layer to this family dynamic. Her relationship with her mother is characterized by mutual avoidance. "We're so similar that we've reached a mutual agreement, there's no point trying anymore." Her father attempts to connect through literature, recommending Kafka's Metamorphosis and trying to nurture her intellectual interests despite her apparent lack of enthusiasm. These well-intentioned but ineffective parental approaches highlight how families can simultaneously care deeply and still fail to provide the support their children need. What makes Osamund's portrayal of mental health so powerful is its refusal to offer simple solutions. Charlie's recovery is portrayed as an ongoing process, with setbacks and small victories. Victoria's own depression, though never explicitly labeled as such, is presented as a complex condition influenced by family dynamics, social pressures, and internal thought patterns. By intertwining these narratives, Osamund creates a nuanced picture of how mental health issues ripple through families, affecting everyone in different ways. Victoria's relationships with her peers reveal the complicated nature of teenage friendships. Her longest-standing friendship is with Becky Allen, a girl with attention-grabbing purple hair who Victoria considers probably my only real friend. Yet even this relationship is fraught with unspoken tensions and misunderstandings. When Becky has sex with her almost boyfriend Jack, Victoria fails to show appropriate interest, later learning they broke up days ago. This pattern of emotional disconnection creates a growing rift between them. The reappearance of Lucas Ryan, Victoria's only friend from primary school, further complicates her social landscape. Their childhood friendship was based on a quiet understanding. When Lucas would cry for no particular reason, Victoria would sit with him and read books. This early connection established a pattern of Victoria feeling most comfortable with people who need her support. When Lucas transfers to her school, Victoria initially feels hopeful about rekindling their friendship, only to be confused and hurt when he begins avoiding her. What makes these friendships particularly compelling is how they reflect different aspects of Victoria's character. Becky represents the social world Victoria feels alienated from, a world of parties, relationships, and normal teenage experiences. Lucas represents a nostalgic connection to a simpler time when friendship didn't require navigating complex social dynamics. Both relationships ultimately falter because Victoria struggles to engage authentically with others, keeping her true thoughts and feelings hidden behind a wall of cynicism and detachment. The novel also explores the darker side of teenage social dynamics through the character of Ben Hope. Initially presented as the universally admired, perfect-haired object of everyone's affection, Ben is revealed to have a troubled history with Charlie. When Ben violently confronts Charlie about spreading lies, we glimpse the homophobia and self-hatred that lie beneath his polished exterior. This subplot powerfully illustrates how social pressures can lead to both external aggression and internal suffering. Osamund's portrayal of teenage friendships avoids the clichés often found in young adult fiction. There are no neat divisions between popular kids and outcasts, no simplistic bullying narratives. Instead, we see complex individuals struggling to connect across the barriers of their own insecurities and defense mechanisms. When Becky tells Victoria she's changed and should find people more like her, it's not a rejection, but an acknowledgement that friendships require some degree of mutual understanding, an effort, something Victoria has been unwilling or unable to provide. Throughout the novel, Victoria grapples with fundamental questions about her identity. When Michael asks about her sexuality, she responds with uncertainty. "I guess I'll just go with straight until proven otherwise." This casual dismissal of the question hints at Victoria's broader disconnection from her own desires and feelings. Unlike many coming-of-age stories where protagonists actively seek to discover who they are, Victoria seems resistant to self-examination, preferring the safety of cynical detachment. This resistance to self-discovery is most evident in Victoria's relationship with literature. Despite claiming to hate reading and dismissing Pride and Prejudice as boring, she reveals a deep understanding of Mr. Darcy's character, defending him as a true hero who struggles on despite being so harshly treated and judged. Her English teacher, Kent, recognizes that Victoria identifies with Darcy rather than Elizabeth, a telling insight into how she sees herself as misunderstood and unfairly judged by others. Victoria's blog represents another facet of her identity struggle. I've realized I'm more of a blog than an actual person, she reflects, suggesting that her online presence has become more authentic than her real-life interactions. This digital extension of self is common for many teenagers, but for Victoria, it represents a deeper fragmentation, a sense that her true self exists only in the private space of her online thoughts. The novel's exploration of identity extends beyond Victoria to include other characters. Charlie's journey of recovery involves reclaiming his identity after his mental health crisis, while Ben Hope's violent outburst reveals the painful disconnect between his public persona and private struggles with his sexuality. Michael Holden's declaration that he's a little bit in love with everyone I meet challenges conventional labels, while his hidden life as a champion speed skater reveals the complexity behind his seemingly simple eccentricity. What makes Osamund's approach to identity particularly nuanced is her refusal to provide easy answers or transformative revelations. Victoria doesn't suddenly discover her true self or undergo a dramatic personality change. Instead, the novel suggests that identity is something continuously negotiated through relationships and experiences. When Victoria writes, "I am Victoria Annabelle Spring" on her arm, it's both an assertion of selfhood and a recognition of how tenuous that selfhood feels. As Solitaire's pranks escalate in danger and Victoria becomes increasingly obsessed with uncovering the truth, the novel builds toward a dramatic confrontation. The revelation that Lucas created Solitaire specifically to bring excitement into Victoria's life comes as a shocking twist. His confession that he saw her playing solitaire in the common room, looking dead and muttering, "I hate myself," recontextualizes the entire mystery. What seemed like a school-wide phenomenon was actually a misguided attempt to connect with one specific person. The final confrontation takes place during a planned school burning, where Lucas has had second thoughts, but his co-conspirators, Aaron, Quiff, and Evelyn, are determined to proceed. When Becky confronts them, her passionate speech cuts to the heart of Solitaire's misguided philosophy. "You think you're so intellectually superior. You think sadness is some kind of disease." This moment represents a powerful rejection of the romanticized nihilism that Solitaire embodies. Despite Becky's intervention, a fire breaks out in the school, creating chaos as students flee the burning building. In this moment of crisis, Victoria finds herself on the Art Conservation's concrete roof, looking down at the snowy ground below. The scene perfectly crystallizes her emotional journey throughout the novel, standing at the literal edge, contemplating whether life is worth the struggle it requires. What makes this climactic scene so powerful is how it brings together all the novel's themes. As Victoria contemplates jumping, she reflects on the various relationships in her life: Lucas's tragedy, Becky and her growing apart, Charlie and Nick's unconventional paradise, Ben Hope's self-hatred. This moment of extreme crisis becomes a lens through which she views her entire social world. The arrival of Michael on the roof provides the emotional climax of the story. His confession that he too wanted the school to burn, that he struggles to make friends and feel normal, creates a moment of profound connection. "Some people aren't meant for school," he tells her. "That doesn't mean they aren't meant for life." This distinction between institutional failure and personal worthlessness offers Victoria a crucial new perspective on her struggles. Their kiss on the roof isn't presented as a magical cure for Victoria's depression or a conventional romantic resolution. Instead, it represents a moment of genuine human connection, something Victoria has been avoiding throughout the novel. Her realization that she no longer wants to jump isn't framed as a happy ending, but as a first step. "I'm not fixed," she acknowledges, but she's chosen to remain in the world rather than escape it. The aftermath of the school fire brings a tentative sense of resolution without offering unrealistic transformation. In Nick's car with Michael, Lupus, Becky, Charlie, and Nick, Victoria experiences a rare moment of genuine connection, as Charlie tells her he noticed her struggles but didn't act. Their exchange of "I love yous" marks perhaps the first time they verbalize their sibling bond, suggesting that authentic communication is possible even after years of silence. Becky's sardonic comment that if this is the best time of our lives, she might as well end it immediately, captures the novel's rejection of platitudes about teenage happiness. Instead of presenting adolescence as a golden time of freedom and discovery, Solitaire acknowledges its profound difficulties while suggesting that connection with others makes these difficulties bearable. The novel's final reflections come as the group crosses the frozen river, with smoke trailing behind them in the sky. Becky observes that Solitaire just wanted them to feel like they belonged to something important. "We're all waiting for something to change. Patience can kill you." This statement recontextualizes the novel's title. Solitaire isn't just about isolation, but about the dangerous patience of waiting for life to improve without taking action. Victoria's concluding thoughts are deliberately ambiguous. "I don't know what will happen to our school or to us, or how long I'll be like this, but I know I'm here, alive and not alone." This isn't a triumphant declaration of healing or happiness. Instead, it's a modest acknowledgement that continuing to exist and maintaining connections with others represents a significant achievement in itself. What makes this ending so powerful is its refusal to offer easy answers or dramatic transformations. Victoria hasn't overcome her depression or suddenly become a different person. Michael hasn't saved her through romantic love. Instead, they've both recognized that genuine human connection, with all its complications and difficulties, provides an alternative to isolation. The school may be in ashes, but the connections formed through crisis offer the possibility of something new emerging from the destruction. In this way, Solitaire presents a vision of adolescence that acknowledges its profound difficulties, while suggesting that these difficulties can be survived through authentic connection with others. Victoria's journey isn't about becoming happy or normal, but about finding ways to remain in the world despite its overwhelming challenges. It's a message that resonates deeply with readers who recognize their own struggles in Victoria's story. A reminder that even in our most isolated moments, connection remains possible. What ultimately makes Solitaire such a compelling exploration of teenage life is its unflinching authenticity. Victoria's voice, cynical, observant, and painfully honest, captures the particular alienation of being a teenager in the digital age. Her observation that "I overthink things, get sad about them, blog, sleep, and will eventually die" distills the existential anxiety that characterizes adolescence for many young people. The novel's exploration of online identity feels particularly prescient. Written in 2012, before social media had fully transformed teenage social dynamics, Solitaire anticipates many of the tensions that would come to define digital adolescence: the gap between online and offline personas, the way virtual connections can both alleviate and intensify feelings of isolation, and the potential for online platforms to become spaces of both expression and manipulation. Victoria's blog represents a private space where she can express thoughts that would be deemed unacceptable in person. It's not socially acceptable to say sad things out loud in the real world without being labeled attention-seeking. This observation highlights how digital spaces can provide crucial outlets for emotional expression while simultaneously reinforcing the expectation that such expressions should remain hidden from everyday life. Solitaire itself represents the darker potential of digital platforms, their ability to coordinate real-world actions, create communities around destructive ideologies, and manipulate vulnerable individuals. When Lucas reveals he created Solitaire specifically to bring excitement into Victoria's life after seeing her play Solitaire while muttering, "I hate myself," we see how digital manipulation can arise from misguided attempts at connection. The novel's exploration of mental health is similarly authentic. Victoria's unnamed depression manifests not as dramatic sadness, but as a pervasive numbness, a feeling of being practically dead inside while going through the motions of normal teenage life. Charlie's eating disorder and self-harm are presented not as dramatic plot devices, but as ongoing struggles requiring therapy, support, and acceptance of occasional relapses. Perhaps most importantly, Solitaire refuses to offer simple solutions to complex problems. Victoria doesn't experience a magical cure for her depression. The school's destruction doesn't create a utopian new beginning. Relationships remain complicated, communication remains difficult, and the future remains uncertain. Yet within this realistic framework, the novel offers a modest but meaningful hope, the possibility of authentic connection in a world that often feels designed to prevent it. As Victoria reflects in the final pages, "I don't know what will happen to our school or to us, or how long I'll be like this, but I know I'm here, alive, and not alone." In a culture that often demands dramatic transformations and happy endings, this simple acknowledgement of continued existence and connection represents a profound truth about surviving adolescence. Sometimes simply remaining in the world and maintaining connections with others is achievement enough.